Hey, welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 71. Yes, my voice is kind of blown out. That's mainly because I did 12 stand-up shows last week. But if you came to any of those shows, thank you a million times. All right, very exciting stuff coming up. April is right around the corner. That is the month we launch Nerdist at Meltdown, our live comedy space at Meltdown Comics in Los Angeles. Just a weird little experiment to see if nerdy comedy can sustain itself in Los Angeles. So, April 2nd is our very first show with comedian Jimmy Dore, his Poppin' Politics show. Then April 4th, Black Dynamite Night. Screening, panel with director and actors, and signing of Slave Island, the first issue of the Black Dynamite comic. April 11th, Nerd Hip Hop from Adam Warrock. April 14th, Rob Schrab will be signing his new book. April 16th, We're Alive Live! The popular serialized zombie podcast comes to Meltdown for a live show. Also, on Wednesdays, you can check out the regular Meltdown comedy show, which is all stand-up, which is run by Jonah Ray and Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon. Then on Sundays through April, at the end of April, we're doing the 826 LA Writers Series. So come and hear talks from super famous writers if you want to learn how to do that. For information about tickets on all these shows, go to meltcomics.com. And then, of course, April 9th, I'm at the Wilbur Theater in Boston, Massachusetts. And then April 14th through the 17th, I'm at the Irvine Improv. And last plug, March 30th, Web Soup returns. Remember that show? Boy, I forgot about that show. But I'm remembering it now because we're making them again. So that starts again March 30th and will be running for a long time. Thank you so much for listening to the show. This episode was recorded without Jonah. He had a little bit of a problem, which I think you learn about halfway through the episode. He was supposed to be there. This guy that we talked to is Brad Meltzer, a legendary writer, comic book writer, also a TV host, a super great guy. And this is a fascinating episode for anyone who's interested in getting into writing. So here we go, the Nerdist Podcast episode number 71 with Brad Meltzer.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I know anything about science, which I don't. That's balancing. There we go.
Let's balance. All right, so we have water. Everything's set.
Yep.
Water.
We're here in
Jonah's empty seat.
Yeah, we're here in Jonah's empty seat. Jonah's not here yet. Jonah Ray's not here yet.
He'll be here.
He's working on something, and we were supposed to record. We were all going to record Scarborough Country this morning.
He didn't make it.
Jonah couldn't make it because he got caught up at work. And he said, "But I'll be there too." And then, you know, so he's not being lazy that he's not here. He's legitimately
doing
working.
Work, folks. For once,
yeah, for once he's doing some really hardcore work, and so we can't get angry and blame him for this. Disrespectful fuck up.
I'm totally disappointed.
That's the voice of Brad Meltzer. Brad, thank you for coming on the Nerdist Podcast.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Brad, you're a nerd. We were talking before about, because I said we did Scarborough Country, which is going to go up way before this will. Matthew Myra,
yes,
is a person who understands sports. And you said, I will understand the least amount of sports. And I said, no, I will understand less than you. And Jonah will understand even less than that. Were he here, he could back that up. But the Sklars have a great way of making sportsy stuff accessible.
Yeah, I don't even care if it's accessible. They understand it. I mean, they come to me and they'll be like, yeah, you know, isn't it funny? That's just like when I'm trying to finish the joke. I can't even finish the joke because all I can think of is Reggie Jackson. That's the only sport. It's like Reggie Jackson and Bucky Dent is all I got.
Now, the only reason I know Reggie Jackson, the only reason I know Reggie Jackson is because of Naked Gun. That's how I know Reggie Jackson.
You don't know the Reggie Bar? Don't you remember the candy bar?
No.
Candy bar.
Mr. October. Reggie Jackson.
I wouldn't go that.
He played in October?
No, I didn't.
Well, October's the playoffs, and he was so good in the playoffs, hitting home runs left and right that they called him Mr. October.
So they just named him after the month? Boy,
Mr.
that is
October.
Typical of sports
That is
fans.
What you'd want to be.
That's sports fan writing.
And then
right
they named...
Hey, he's hitting his fan in the month of October. We should call him after this month.
But that's when the playoffs happen, so he comes through in the clutch.
Why don't
Chris?
They call him Mr. Playoffs?
Well, no, that's stupider.
But you can't grant him
but
the
it's
entire
funny because
month of October.
Years
you
and
can't
years
give
later,
him a whole calendar month.
Years and years later, they named A-Rod Mr. April.
Oh my God! We're giving
because he does nothing. He doesn't want. It doesn't count. It doesn't matter.
Hey, the only April I want to see is a foldout of a naked magazine.
Right.
You looked like you wanted
of
to
a,
say something
of a girl
more.
Named April, or
yes, April and April.
April
and then
April.
She's having sex with another girl named April, so it's April and April and April.
Could
it
be
just
April.
Keeps going deeper and deeper
what's her
and
name?
Deeper.
April O'Neil.
Could be April O'Neil.
The porn lady.
That one I know.
Oh, see.
I can get you that. But the
go.
Sad part is
she's very attractive.
I thought April O'Neil was isn't she Ninja Turtles?
I believe that's where she got her name from.
Yeah, see, I know that's I pretty much proved it right there. That you see a porn star, and I go, isn't that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles leader?
That's how we back into
well,
everything.
She's not a leader.
That's how the nerd community
that's
backs
where she
into
got
everything.
The name?
I would assume, right? You don't just pull April O'Neil out of
that
nowhere.
Assume the porn star comes out of the Ninja Turtles?
The Freemasons that's probably
stuff.
Did it, Brad.
It probably was.
Uh-oh.
You
brought up the Freemasons. Did you already talk about this?
Oh, we talked about it a little bit.
Okay, we're going to get to...
No, we'll talk about it later.
We're going to get to Decoded...
As we move on.
In just a second. By the way, April O'Neil does listen to this podcast. I ran into her in...
Oh,
at,
hello.
CES/AEE mm-hmm. when I did my little... My little menage with the two giant conventions, and she's very sweet. She was very sweet. There's a lot of interest. I'm fascinated. There's a lot of interesting, funny girls in the porn world right now.
There are also a lot of damaged, sad people in the porn industry.
Yeah, I mean, if you want
to, I feel like
if you want to talk about the majority of what's
be like
happening,
90-10.
See, my favorite
sure.
porn star moment is I was at San Diego a couple years ago, and there was on the right hand side they had you know how they always bring like the big booby girls to like attract
sure.
the nerds and they,
of course
and so Ooh, they
babes.
Have that right. And so now they have a hole on the right hand side is that, and on the left hand side. It was a guy who had all these superpowers action figures that were for sale, you know. And the sad part is as I walked down the aisle, it was the superpowers booth that was absolutely filled, and the booby girls were nowhere. And everyone was like, "Did they got a cyborg figure back here?" And the sad part for me is I looked at it and I went. They got Cyborg there? And I literally walked out, and so that was pretty
so
much
So all I could think of is when you said Superpowers Booth was that the actor Powers Booth was in some sort of nuclear accident.
Yeah.
Superpowers.
Yeah. Which totally would have helped him...
that would have saved the career.
Well, yeah, and it also would have helped him take over Swearingen's joint from the Bella Union to take over Swearingen's joint. I was not the only person who saw Deadwood in this room, right?
No, but
Powers
I feel like... our audience might not have watched Deadwood.
I think our audience watched Deadwood. Are you fucking
Deadwood.
Kidding me?
I think they watched Deadwood.
That was one of the nerdiest.
No,
that show was.
They swore a lot, and that hurt me.
Yeah, but you know,
yeah, David Mills that immediately attracts it. It's like the Fireflies right there. They're coming right to it.
Deadwood is fantastic to burn through fast,
and then disappointing in the end when
yeah,
you realize
well,
that it's not ever going to pay off.
Yeah, I never watched it, and I wanted to. It was one of my blind spots, and I wanted to watch. My buddy Noah, who actually loves your podcast, and I said his name, tell him that everyone should have sex with him. But
please
have sex with Noah.
You know, he said, but he would be like, you know, and he sends like things like just an email that just says Deadwood, and that. That's the argument. That's his entire argument. It would be like that. I'm like, that's it? That's what you got? But that's his way of getting me to watch, but I never
watched
it. Are
you sure that's not him saying that he wants to have sex but can't because
no.
of a
oh,
physical
he can't.
Ailment?
No, he can't, but he can't. He actually
he's
can.
Saying Deadwood. Like,
yeah,
he's
no.
Got
the best part is he's on Twitter now bitching and moaning, but he's actually awesome. He's the last thing he emailed me is he went to the bathroom. He weighed himself, and then he went to the bathroom and took a dump, and then he weighed himself again. And then he knew the exact weight of his dump.
Of
and
course.
Was like, and then he just wrote, like, you know, 6 ounces. And that was the argument. and I wrote back.
We
to
might have a little more trouble getting this guy laid.
Yeah.
Although, if our podcast did have that kind of power. Actually,
Noah's
no, we
best.
Don't. We don't have that kind of power. Right. We can't get people laid.
Yes,
no,
you can.
I could.
My goal would be if you can find a girlfriend for my Noah's the guy who I named the calculator after in Identity Crisis.
Oh wow!
And I said to him, why don't you put? And the best part is when he Googles himself now, instead of his like real name coming up as Noah Cutler, he comes up as the calculator. So like he, you know, people are like, wow, you're a supervillain, and I would think that would get you laid.
That's pretty incredible.
I think so.
When I worked at Nickelodeon, there was an executive there whose last name was Poindexter. And he is the Poindexter from the Young MC song, Bust a Move. They went to college together.
That's wow. That
absolutely.
100%. But you can't, how do you prove it? Prove that he's with Young MC.
I guess he has to be with Young MC, and Young MC is physically holding a word bubble that says, "I named him after this guy."
Yeah, because I went to school.
Pixar didn't happen.
To camp with Anthony Leone, and he used to tell us that Mama Leone mm-hmm. in the Billy Joel song was his mama.
Really?
And I believed it for years. I was like, well, you know, because we used to go to the camp, and camp was we called the country. It mm-hmm. was called the country because it was out of Brooklyn, and if you were upstate New York, that was called the country. And he says, Mama Leone left a note on the door, so sending you know out to the country, and I was like, I totally believed him for a year. In fact, I still believe him now. Of course, it's bullshit. You believe now. You're believing it.
Well, because I should know this because my girlfriend's name is Janet Varney, and for years she told everyone she was related to Jim Varney just for
sure.
The fuck of it.
Yeah, why not? I believe it.
And it was not. It turned out not to be true. But although I'm sure in
turned
some
out not to be.
I'm sure in some way. I mean, she didn't tell people that for any kind of
gain. Right.
This was when she was in grade school. You know, she said that they were related.
I saw Jim Varney's. I remember the last movie I went and saw it in the theater, The 99 Cents, the last Ernest movie.
Oh, which one was that? Africa?
I think maybe it wasn't the last. Then there clearly might have been a last. I think it was Camp. It was probably
Ernest
after
goes
camp.
To camp. I feel like there Africa after was that. After
Africa.
That.
I didn't know it was Africa.
Okay.
That sounds like a bad, sad movie,
Brad,
actually.
Brad, you're a writer. Here's what we're going to do.
Yeah, let's
do it. We're going to do a very meta... We're gonna do Jim Varney's final movie, and it's going to be a meta movie. It'll be Jim Varney Wants Brains, and it's Jim Varney's zombie has dragged itself out of the earth and is now trying to devour Vern's brains.
He's not dead.
He's way dead.
He's dead?
Yeah.
He's been dead for like a decade.
So this is really tasteless in many ways. I love it.
Yeah, and so we just, hey, Vern! Like, you wouldn't even have to do a spot on Jim Varney. You just have to have the vest and the...
Yeah, oh yeah.
They had to recast Slinky Dog in Toy Story 3.
Oh,
they did. I didn't think about that.
I thought
that
about
makes
it
me sad. Thanks
constantly.
For bringing it down.
Well, if they really cared about him, they would use a Ouija board to summon him through a medium.
The thing is when you look at that first one, it's kind of like the lady in Where's the Beef? The first ones are gold.
Clara Peller.
Clara Peller, love her. Clara Peller still, like, it's still gold to me. You can't take it away from me. It doesn't matter that they milked it and killed it.
Yeah.
Like, the first Jim Varney is still funny to me.
Just like the first Matrix movie. We talked about this, right?
The first Matrix. I just did a thing where they asked me to do the best conspiracy movies, and the Matrix was... It went down on the list, obviously, because of the last two, which I hold against the first one, as if it's personal for me, which it is. Mm-hmm. But the first one is still golden.
The same exact conversation with Kevin Smith, where it was just like, you get so angry about the second two.
Or the first three, hypothetically, George Lucas. Right? Yeah. I mean, that's it, right?
Well, they're talking about doing two more.
Don't do that. You know what makes me feel inside?
Now it's going to go off my list.
What it makes me feel inside when I watch the second two is that episode of The Simpsons where they add Poochie. Poochie the dog, and they all gather around to watch, and Poochie keeps them from getting to the fireworks factory, and Milhouse starts crying and goes, "When are they going to get to the fireworks factory?" Like, I feel the same way about The Matrix 2. Like, when are they going to come back into The Matrix?
It's so sad.
Yep.
And even the supposedly, like, turn us on orgasm scene with a woman, like, which was really just the gratuitous thing to make the fanboys go like, oh look, there's an orgasm on screen. Even that wasn't working. Like,
right.
If you can't make that work, and that was, but there are ways to redeem it. Like, for me, the Star Wars movies with my son who's 9 years old, I made him watch. Like, I was so kind of angry at the first three that what I did with the third, I actually started obviously, of course, with A New Hope,
mm-hmm.
and then I didn't tell him that there were any more movies, and I made him wait. I didn't want him to just consume them.
Mm-hmm.
So what I actually did is. I just pretended there were no other movies, and I made him wait 6 months to watch a new movie.
Very smart.
Then I would be like, because I felt like if he just watched them, it would just be like,
withheld The Empire Strikes Back.
I withheld The Empire Strikes Back for 6 months, and then he got a little older, and I gave him that, and then I gave him Jedi. And then I had no choice but to go back. But it was interesting because my nephew, he didn't do that. My brother-in-law, he actually let him watch all of them from the start, and he had no joy in his life, and he's a miserable kid now. And he also had no shock and surprise from Yoda. Right, he saw Yoda. I mean, think of it. That key moment is like when you watch it from the beginning, you watch it in that order. And I actually hate all Star Wars references and jokes now because even they all seem old. But it's amazing with kids, you have to take it into your own hands or else it just gets ruined for them.
That's very smart. You actually became the entertainment business to your kids.
I did.
For us. And by the way, if this makes you feel any better about the second and third Matrix, here's how I think of it. I imagine that the second and third Matrix... that's Neo in the Matrix, and it's the Matrix's interpretation of how the story would have continued, that he's still in a chair somewhere, and that those actually were not the second, third Matrix
movies. I appreciate
the
effort that goes into that, but it doesn't give me my $8 back.
No, no, or your time.
Yeah.
Or your time.
Yeah, I don't care about my time. I care about my $8.
But you, you're right. You worked with Joss Whedon, and who is such a sweet guy,
sweetheart,
and a genius.
It's amazing. And we have just very different brains. When we were working together, I have just a very plot-driven brain, mm-hmm. you know. And he basically sent out, when we were doing Buffy, he sent out this email to the people who were writing on it. And he said, you know, tell me what you want to write and tell me what you like and any characters. And because he's, you know, again, very generous and lets you pick out. He's like, I'm not going to force the story on you. If you love Xander, you want to tell your ultimate Xander story, go to it, which mm-hmm. is great. And my brain needs plot. I do. It's like, to me, that's the clothesline to hang the characters on. I mm-hmm. need to know what they're doing. And so most people wrote back and said, oh, I want to do Xander in Japan. And you know, and then they got to do Xander in Japan. And I wrote back like, when you watch Jerry Maguire and he writes his letter, like the mission letter, mm-hmm. I wrote this like mission letter that was, you know, 3 pages, single spaced, insane, you know, with an entire idea for how the universe works and how the Buffy universe should exist and all that stuff. And it was just like fanfic, you know, to the world, including the sex and everything else. And I wrote it to him and I said, you know, either if you don't like this, just delete it and just say I'm sorry and I'm fired and it's okay. And he wrote back and said, you know, there's some things I hate, there are some things I like, but I want you to write the penultimate thing. And I was like, oh my gosh, now I got to do this thing. But what was amazing, when he got on the phone, my brain is going plop, 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 and his brain just goes character, 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 which mm-hmm. I admire so much because that comes so naturally to him, as much as plot comes much more naturally to me, even though I still have to struggle with it. And I'm just fascinated because to do character, 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 you just have to have a depth of emotion that I clearly have none of. But I mean, when he would talk, I'd be like, "Yeah, you know these characters really well. Good job."
So when you're writing, that's very interesting that you say that, because I'm in the process of writing a book now, and previously I had just written, you know, like feature length magazine articles and blog posts, and so you know, there was a time where like, oh, 4,000 words, that's a little bit of, and now when I look back, I've learned so much just in the process of writing this book, and to hear you say that you sort of wrote the character Bible before you actually started, you know, like you wrote his story before you started writing what you were going
to
write.
Oh, I have to do 6 months of character.
You really need to, like, that's what I'm learning with the book, is that I had to write the outline first. And then that informs. It's not like you sit down and go, well, I'm just going to start writing 55,000 words.
You know, some people do. Some people sit down and say, let's see where the day takes me. My character will take me to a magical place. I can't do that. I write mysteries. I write thrillers. I need to know who done it, so I need to know who to leave out of the room while the done it's happening. But the one thing I do is I don't plot the whole thing, though. Mm-hmm. Because I once plotted a whole book start to finish, and it was no fun to write because there was nothing spontaneous about it. It was like following, you know, it was like playing connect the dots. It's not really that fun.
And it really is interesting when you're sitting down to write and you just have a general idea, maybe thematically, or just an idea that you want to get across, just the way that in the moment your brain expresses things that you never would have thought of if you just sat there really hard and tried to...
Yeah. It's I promise you, when you get to the end of your book, you're going to come back around, the snake's going to swallow its tail, and you're going to start rewriting the beginning because you're going to know your characters so much better.
Well, it's a nonfiction book. It's like a time management book for nerds. But
yeah, then you won't do any of that.
I won't do any of that. But what I probably will do is go back and rewrite some of the stuff in the beginning because I feel like the voice got, you know, sure. like developed more, you know, halfway through it.
No, I still do that. I still, when I get to the end, go, oh, now I know the characters so much better. Let's go back. And, you know, you find, even when you're doing nonfiction, when I did this book, Heroes for My Son, and I got back and I was like, you know what? I finally saw the thread that was emotionally pulling through this thing mm-hmm. that I didn't have at the beginning, but when I saw it 50 times in a row, it's kind of like when you study for a final, right? You don't understand the class the entire semester. Well, this is my life here, but I don't understand the class the entire semester, and then in the finals, I'm like, wow, I wish I knew that because I would have actually enjoyed that class.
Right.
Because now I see the thread that was actually going through here.
And so what I'm curious about is, because I think it's very important to understand what your productivity chunks are. And I know that I'm good for an hour, hour and a half of, you know, uninterrupted, like I can spit out a bunch of stuff in an hour and a half. Can you write like it's a job, like you write for 8 hours or 10 hours in a day?
My superpowers, first of all, my superpowers, I can sit. I can sit for, I mean, if there were sitting, I can
undistracted?
Sit. Undistracted? I can sit and not move like Stone Boy. I mean, I can sit like nobody's, I mean, and my one rule is sit there. Even if you have nothing to write, sit there.
That is so important.
But I will say, when I get stuck, like when you just like, you know what, I don't know what they should do here in this moment, then I will use distractions. I'll use the internet. I'll use my pal Noah. I'll call him up. I'll do stuff like that. Because to me, the moment you step in the shower is when the phone rings. Mm-hmm. So when I'm stuck, I will use a distraction on purpose.
Oh,
but I force myself to treat it as a job.
I think it's really important, and I wish I did it more. I worked on a cartoon for years called Barnyard that this guy named Steve Odekirk executive produced. And so Steve, we were talking about, you know, the writing process, and I said, you know,
did he use his thumb?
We had thumb. Yeah. We did the thumb. And
that was a good bit.
That was a good bit.
I love that bit.
I know he was trying to develop the thumbs for some other stuff. I hope he brings them back.
Okay.
You're going to single-handedly bring them back.
You're going to single-handedly bring them back with this podcast. But but I said, it's so hard because I want to get up and I want to write every day. I think it's very important. Stand-up is one of those things that's very difficult to do that with for me because, you know, it's trying to figure. It's not really a long story. You're just kind of writing short-form bits. And I said, you know, I'll just sit there, and I guess it's sort of important just to get the crap out of my brain. And he said, yes, it's important to do that because it sets you up for the good moments that you will have later.
Exactly.
You have to get all that shit out
right
before you can get to the good stuff. So that's why. So even just for the exercise of doing it regularly, just to get the wheels turning, he said, was very important.
No, it's Gertrude Stein, right? To write is to write is to write is to write. I read this. When I first started writing, I went into a bookstore and read all the stuff about working at home because I was terrified. I was like, you know, I don't have anyone to speak to, and I like to speak to people sometimes. And they said basically the rule that I read, and I took it because it just seemed like the gospel, is I get up in the morning. They said, go walk around somewhere. Get out of your house because if you don't, you're never going to feel like you went anywhere. You're going to just be stuck in your home life as opposed to your work life.
Mm-hmm.
So I do that. And then it said it said, just write, you know, just keep doing it, even if it's bad. And what I do is I write the entire day, and it's like squeezing a sponge dry. And sometimes I'll peter out. I can write from 10 in the morning until about 4.
Oh, that's great!
But
so jealous.
I used to write 8 pages in that time, and then I started writing 6 pages, and then I was happy if I got 3 pages. Now I'm happy if I get 2 pages. My rationalization is I'm writing better, right? But it's not. It's just that, and then when I get to the end of the day, I never look back at what I wrote, but the next day I start by going through what I wrote. And then you see what crap it was, but you can cross out the crap and keep the good.
Right.
And you need crap there to find the good. You have to wade through something. So I think Odenkirk is on the money. I mean, you have to get it down.
Well, and in stand-up, wading through the crap is, you know, sometimes that's when you're workshopping stuff on stage and you know.
I was gonna say, to me, stand-up, like, and I do my own, you know, it's not comedy like you do comedy, but to me, you can only do it in front of an audience. You see, you feel that moment of what works. You know that you write that joke, and then you see, like, I had a line last night that I was talking about, and I actually said it in a different way just by accident, and the audience totally reacted to it. And you can't find that sitting alone in my room. It has to be kind of thrown into the...
I think on a very deep molecular level, what's happening is, you know, your unconscious mind is essentially, you know, if you're a focused performer, has already taken in... It's sort of the Malcolm Gladwell thing. You've already taken all the surroundings. You just don't realize that
right.
You have. And so you've connected with all these people. You know, if you're really connected with them, stuff's going to come out the right way that you couldn't have predicted because, you know, you're in that moment.
Right, but you're comfortable.
But I don't think it's an accident. I think on a deep level, your brain knows what it's doing. You just can't force it. You just can't force it to happen.
It's
and you're not aware of it, that it's happening.
That's true what happened last night. Because it was actually being honest in a way that I wouldn't have been honest with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I was holding back my own, like I wasn't going to say this about this woman because I used to date her. And I said what I really thought, and it was funnier, but I would have never given him that. So it was my subconscious saying, schmuck, listen.
It is, you know, because I think, you know, many times you can write something that you think like, oh, this joke is going to be, this is going to be a closer here.
Yeah, that's as good
a kiss of
death as there is.
And I think the problem that happens with those jokes are twofold. Number one, if you think something is too funny, it's probably too inside your own head.
Right.
And
yeah.
Other people can't relate to it. And it's like when I used to do this, years ago, I used to do this open mic at the Westwood Brewing Company.
Yeah,
and sometimes, because it's all comics doing open mic, sometimes stuff that killed too hard there would not work in other rooms because it was just too inside.
That's
it was
true.
Just too insular.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have to... Listen, that's rule right. Know your audience. Rule number one.
And the other thing that happens is I think when you are presenting a joke that you think is hilarious, it comes from a different place in your brain
right.
than
no,
those
it's
sort of
precious,
organic
it's
moments.
It's a precious moment. Of
absolutely.
I mean, you, can,
you can't force
it can't
that.
Can't be as good, right?
No.
I agree.
What show did you do last night?
I present every night when I go on book tour. What I do is I turn it into, you know, an open mic and a Q&A and all that, and I was just telling the story of these, you know, my two little crushes from third grade who I was in love with, and basically, but I like to do comedy. I mean, that's where it comes from, and I like to make people laugh, and people come and they think they're buying a book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny, you know, again, not that I think I'm a stand-up, not that I do any sort of that stuff, but it's just a funny story. And so I was just telling it last night, and suddenly the audience really started laughing. You know, you feel it. And in a big room, it was actually a big room, which mm-hmm. I think are much harder performing because you can't read the audience as well, especially when half the room was empty because I was me and nobody came. But but beyond that, I could read the – I mean, I couldn't read it as well,
oh,
but I felt
there,
the audience suddenly explode, and I was like – oh, I'm going to use that. And then suddenly that's the new way to do it. I'll do that tonight.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, what's really funny about a bit is that you can have a bit that's not kind of working or not working, and then something happens in a moment or just a way that you tweak it or just some way you can ultimately connect it with an audience, and then they respond to it in a huge way. And then from then on, usually the bit... And you're like, what? It changed. And,
I know,
and
I love
it's
that.
Just something about
it's
just something about the chemistry and something about your brain and something about how you're more comfortable with it.
See, I was going to say, it's all about comfort. To me, that's what people read. What people read is when you're comfortable and being – I think everything that we've spoken about is all about one thing, and that's being yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like you said, you write in short form and short form and short form. You don't, actually. What you're trying to get to – like, and I know you talk about this on the podcast. You talk about how – you know, you want to be there's a comedian, and then there's a comedian who comes for you. Not that people are coming just, you know, because they like comedians, but they mm-hmm. want to come and see Chris.
Yeah.
And to me, the difference for that is you being yourself. That's what they're coming for. It's not because you're talking about things that are nerdy or you're talking about, you know, the Matrix. It's because they feel you. And when you get to that comfort level where they feel you, that's when, you know, you're not telling a joke to an audience. It's like now it's a joke among friends, which is the best kind of joke.
I could not agree more. And those are the people that you want to perform for. Because you will obviously have more to say to them, and you
sure.
don't have to pander. You don't
no,
have to.
But you put me in Boca Raton, Florida, among the Jews. That's my favorite audience, right? Because one, I'm related to half of them, so I laugh at anything. So that's good. But the truth is, I'm myself. I'm, and for me, it took me years before. I mean, you look at my earliest interviews that I did when I started writing, and I would do what the publisher said. I wouldn't ever lie, but I was just, you know, happy guy, happy to be here. Everything's good. And why? Because I was afraid to be myself. You're
yeah.
afraid to put yourself out there.
Not only that, Brad, but it's. I think the other challenge is that a lot of people don't know who they are. Like in the stand-up process
true
and in the writing process,
100%.
It's a combination of, well, not only am I not comfortable with who I am, I don't even know
no,
who that
right,
is.
That's it, right. You don't.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly
and that's
right.
why it takes so long for comics to find their voice because... You know, most people in their lives are never required to try to get that perspective on themselves because they just react to things, and it becomes very different when you start saying, well, how do I normally react to things? It's sort of like how you just learn English because that's a language that you're brought up around, but when you start learning another language, you're like, what's the subjunctive tense? Like,
you
don't think of it as a structure and a process.
Right, but I even think... Even when you do know who you are, I mean, I look at my first novel, that first character I ever wrote is me, right? I know it's me, not on purpose. It's just because all I was energy,
mm-hmm.
right? I was just like so excited to be on the written page that I was going, you know what? I'm going to put myself out there 100%, and I didn't even realize I was putting myself out there. I just, everyone I wrote was me, every character was me. In the new novel, it's me, but on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a better and more on purpose than ever before, but it's a more complex character because I'm not afraid to say that I'm nervous, I'm anxious, I'm strong, and I'm weak, and, you know, all those things, which I would never do in the first book. I would hide all the negatives and give you all the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it's comfort, part of it's understanding, part of it's getting older, but I do think that there's a tipping point where you get, you know, you navel gaze so much that you lose your edge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think, like, there's that... You know, there's like the 20-year-old comedian, and then there's like that 30-year-old where you're in your, you know, that 30 to maybe early 40 where you're in your prime.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get older, right, you see these guys who get older and they lose something. And
well,
I don't know if it's that they got too comfortable.
It's their marbles.
I don't know if it's money. I don't know what it is, but it's interesting.
I think there are two things. Because I think, I mean, if you really think about it, a lot of big comics really don't hit until they're in their 40s.
Yeah, well, and hit big. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Hit early
40s.
I mean, there's, you know, there are a few exceptions. Chris Rock is an exception. Chappelle is an exception. Dane Cook was an exception. But most of them don't really hit huge until their 40s because it takes about that long. But I think what happens, and I think this is one of Carlin's big things. It's just about. I think it's an energy thing and a comfort thing. And if all of a sudden you're a mega multimillionaire, number one,
well, that just takes away your.
You're not having
edge,
the same experience
right.
that other people. Right. You're that's not right. you're not hungry anymore.
No, when you lose that hunger,
and
that's
you don't
it.
Have the energy, you just don't really fucking. The comic gene is a defective thing where you say. I need to make people like what I'm saying.
Sure.
And then when you get older, you just kind of get more comfortable with who you are. It's like, I don't give a fuck what anyone thinks anymore.
No, that's right. But I do think, though, that what were we just talking? Because I was on the money with what you were saying, and now I forgot it. It was actually the most brilliant point I was going to make.
40s, people in their 40s, people in their 40s, people
getting older.
Older
getting
something a cat would say.
Okay. Ready, go.
I will tell you, though, that speaking of the $50,000 or $100,000 pyramid, I got to stay home from school one day because John Tremonti's mom was on it, and Shelley Duvall was giving clues, and I totally knew she was going to lose. And I was mad at my mom because she wouldn't let me gamble on it because I knew the answer.
But
I did get to stay home from school for that. That has nothing to do with it.
Who would you have put that bet in with?
Right. I mean, I was like in seventh grade. But I mean, I would have taken Andrew Goldberg's money and, you know.
Sure.
All right, so we were talking about comics in their 40s. I was talking about Louis. Boy, I wish we could just go back and listen to this.
Someday. We'll have the technology.
Yeah.
No, listen, if it pops back in your head, spit it out, and no matter what we're talking about. I think it's just a comfort thing. I think people just get, they just don't really care what other people think anymore. And when, you know, like if you don't have that motivation of like, oh, I got to get out there and say something because I have all this energy inside me, then you're just not going to. You know, you're just not gonna. I'm sure a lot of comics stop watching comedy as they get older because they just get tired of it. I can see your head.
I got to get back to it because it really was the point that I 100% like. I feel like is what life is all about, and it's that important to me. So I'm just gonna sit here in silence.
Okay, let's just give Brad a moment of silence.
Son of a bitch! I hate getting older like this. No, but I do that. You know, it was something you said about Chris Rock. That's what I was thinking about.
Chris Rock.
Yeah, it was something about Chris Rock.
Was it Chappelle?
No. And Carlin. You're talking about my heroes here. But I do think. I'm sorry. I have totally wrecked this whole thing.
No, you have. You can't wreck this podcast.
Let's see if we can.
Please.
Yeah, but
it can be done.
It's the Lusitania. Oh shit.
No, it is. I like the Lusitania. That's a good reference. Far better than Titanic.
Both
Cunard luxury liners of the same era or ilk.
But I do think as you get, I think there is something that as you get older and you know, it's not even about losing your edge or about losing what you interact with. I think you just, I don't know. There's something that's in you that gets broken, and you either whether you fix or whether you fix on purpose, and it's going to drive me crazy until I think about it. So I'm going to let you take us to our next topic.
That's fine. Let's talk a little bit about Decoded, because when I said you were coming on, I have to be honest. Now Matt, who is a huge Matt is there. There are three things that I know Matt loves.
Yes.
Matt loves the Boston Red Sox.
That's
which
true.
That means very little to me. I don't understand sports. Matt also loves NASA. Any historical NASA stuff. He's a NASA nerd.
I love NASA.
And he loves history stuff. Loves history stuff.
Yeah. I enjoy
and so
that.
I said, and this should be a compliment because this means that he watched the show. I said, you know, Brad Meltzer's going to come on. He hosts the show Decoded, and Matt said. They always blame it on the Freemasons.
I said, which episodes did you watch? And he tells me which two episodes. I'm like, yeah, those are the Freemason ones. The whole season. What I like about the show is everything is blamed on the Freemasons. We are the same, which is like, people, the Freemasons are not eating your babies. I promise you. They're stealing your car. But
what do you think about
babies.
The fact that I heard, and I said this on the Kevin Smith one, I believe, and it was, I remembered who told me, it was Tom Lennon told me this. The Freemasons, when you get to the 33rd level of Freemasonry, they kill you momentarily and then bring you back to life so there are no more secrets.
No, if they do that,
I
don't know.
Yeah, with the level, right? And their right angles. The whole thing is that they fake it. Here's the coolest nerdy thing about the Freemasons. They have one of their induction ceremonies, when you get one of the degrees, is based on this harem story, and it's basically about lowering into a pit, and you have to lower him down into a pit. And I'll spare you the whole story of harem and what it's supposed to be. but it's actually the moment in Raiders when he goes down on the rope into the snake pit.
Holy shit.
That's the recreation of the degree that they do in Freemasonry.
That,
and it's built into the Raiders.
I love that.
I love that stuff. I mean, that to me is like, I'm like, okay, now we're talking about interesting Freemason stuff to me. And the Freemason guys are like, that's what you care about, the Raiders connection. I'm like, it's Raiders, man. It's the,
they never told me there'd be snakes.
Yeah, that's good. I like that.
That's fantastic.
That's true. That's exactly where it comes from.
What'd you think of National Treasure?
You know, I can't bitch about it because, let's be honest, I wouldn't have decoded if the National Treasure didn't work, right?
Right.
History Channel would have never tried to do anything like this if that didn't work. But I don't know. I guess I like my, you know, and I love the movie and, I, you know, it's fun and it's, but you know what it is. You know what you're getting in it. And
yeah.
I just like my stuff a little bit more grounded in reality. I don't like the, for me, and I guess it's good on film, but like, you know, when you look at the clue and go, you know, it's like right out of Adam West Batman, it's like, oh my gosh, I know what it means. It's the Resolute Desk, which had this, and it was made by this and such maker, and so on. And I'm like, that's just too fast. I don't care how good you are. Like, even Sherlock Holmes wasn't that fast. You know,
that's how good he was, though.
Yeah, but he was good.
He was very good.
But if you
good.
Were that good,
John
I guess
Voight
really
raised him well.
He raised
the
him
first
well.
One was fun.
He got to nail Diane Kruger.
Yes, a lot of good
so
things.
That's good. That's
that worked out
too.
Pretty
yeah,
well.
I like that. That was a good part of the movie.
You know what made me mad, though? This made me mad at the end of the movie. This is going to just show what a materialistic cock I am. When they offer him up
1%,
when they offer him 1% of the treasure, which would have, you know, been worth $1 billion or whatever it was,
yeah.
And he was like, it's too much wealth for one man. I'm like, no, it's really not. You should have just fucking taken it. Like his entire family tree was wrecked in pursuit of this treasure.
Wait, didn't he end up taking some money?
He got a car. That was the thing. He had like a then he had a Ferrari.
He had a Ferrari and I believe an estate. I
yeah,
think he took some of the money.
Yeah, but he only took $100 million as opposed to the billion that he could have taken.
Oh, I see.
And he could have, you know, his family completely wrecking their lives in pursuit of this treasure is worth the $1 billion. Like,
also,
just take the fucking $1 billion.
I was just mad about the car. I was like, that's what you spend it on? I actually judge what he spends the money on.
But it wasn't Nicolas Cage.
Real Nicolas Cage
character.
Would have spent
it was
the
his
money
sidekick,
on Ferraris.
The role,
he got the car.
The role that I probably would have read for if I...
you actually would have.
Yeah, it's like the snarky sidekick with the crazy... Crazy messed up hair.
That's not overdone at all.
No, not at all.
There's a lot of more parts. But
it was like the complete... Nick Cage played the complete opposite of his real character, which is buy multiple houses and Ferraris.
Yes. And file
for
bankruptcy. Real Nick Cage would have taken the Ferraris after finding... Real Nick Cage really does need to find lost treasure. What if he goes crazy and he's like, I better start looking for the clues on the money because if I need this shit...
He bought two houses in New Orleans, like blocks from each other? Like...
That's good crazy.
It's fantastic.
That's awesome to me. Love that. The thing about Nick Cage, though, I don't care how many stories you have, it's the comic book collection, and his name is from Luke Cage.
Yeah.
You get, I don't care what you do, you get like.
And that
awesome.
His son is named Kal-El?
Yeah, that's when you always go a little far. The Fonz, if you name your kid the Fonz, I'm okay with, but like the Kal-El thing, but. You know, Luke Cage that was good stuff because I would have named myself Coppola. I would have taken full credit. I would have been like, dude, my man's the man. I respect people that change their name when their dad is famous and like say I'm going to go my way because I was fooled. It was a good secret ID for me. I didn't know it all.
Yeah. I mean, the truth is Nicolas Cage does some movies that I think are phenomenal.
Dude, Moonstruck is a brilliant movie.
Moonstruck
Magic
is a great
Man's
movie.
Really
I love that adaptation.
Adaptation's a brilliant movie.
And, you know, so that's why I'm forgiving of Season of the Witch.
Are you? You're forgiving of that?
Well, I mean, you know, people have to work. You got to work. And the thing is...
Listen, everything can't be great.
And he does. He
great.
Does.
My whole career is based on that theory.
He does have to work now.
He really does have to work now. And you know, the truth of the matter is, you just... I remember who we had this conversation with. Kevin Pollak, I think. You just don't ever really know how something's going to turn out. There are too many people involved with editors and directors and studio people and lighting. Like, you just... There are too many facts. It's surprising that any movie is ever good.
When we did Jack and Bobby, they taught me on the very first day, they were like, this is going to be like pushing water. You know, because I'm used to a novel. A novel is... You know, kind of like stand-up. It's your thing, right? It's the house you build with your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have an editor. You may have someone that reacts to it and helps you along the way. But, you know, it's your train to drive off the cliff. And they were like, and we would write an episode of Jack and Bobby. Okay, we, you know, create the show, write the episode. You know, the showrunner would make some changes. The studio would ask for some changes. The network would ask for some changes. You'd have the stars of the show say, I don't want to look like a jerk this week, Brad. Can you make me nice? And the editing guy would make a serious long scene and say, well, we got a commercial break and tighten it. The music he'd take a really serious scene and put like a light ting, ting, ting on the piano that would make it a little comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would watch the episode that would have my name on it. I would say, written by Stephen A. Cohn and Brad Meltzer. And I'd watch the episode and go, wow, I wonder what's going to happen next. Like, it was like, just that you have no idea what you're going to get. And that's, and you know, the guys who, I remember when they first bought my first novel, I sat down with the two screenwriters, and they came, they flew to D.C., and they said, and I said, this is going to be good or is this going to be crap? You guys are going to ruin this. You know, don't ruin my book.
Mm-hmm.
And I was such a schmuck, like, young kid, you know, just excited to be there. And he said, listen. He's like, listen, you dumbass. He said, nobody goes out to make a bad movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sat there and I was like.
Except for The Matrix 2 and 3.
And Planet of the Apes remake. They did that on purpose. And I literally was like, you're right. That's it. You can't control it. Nobody says, oh, you know what? I got an idea. Let's make a sucky one. It's going to be awesome.
Well, here's what people don't understand. And here's what sometimes people don't understand in the industry. And you know, I've had this conversation before as someone who's hosted stuff. The same is true for you when your name is on the credit as a writer. But when people go in and fuck with things, or like when they add a crazy sound effect or something, people watching aren't going to go, that sound effects guy, what the fuck was he thinking? They're
going to
go, oh, written by Brad Meltzer. Oh, fuck, why'd that guy fucking make that? They you know, because you become the name and the face associated with it. So most people just think that you're responsible for every aspect of it, and they blame you for it.
Right. See, Jack and Bobby, no one blamed me for anything because it was such a collaborative effort, right? And it wasn't my show. Decoded, it says my name above the title.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that goes wrong, like if we pick a dumb thing, like you blame the Freemasons. Look, you see, he blamed it right on me. See what he did? He was like, they get the Freemasons. Like, it's my fault that the Freemasons did everything in the world, right? I mean, that's my fault. And
might
the
be.
Thing is,
it might be.
I
don't know.
Actually,
they're crafty.
They are crafty.
Are you some kind of weird steampunk Freemason android?
You know what the best part is? Is there's a guy on the internet now that says, because I did this photo that was in the paper, and he literally is like, Brad Meltzer's flashing Freemason signs. I guess my hands were in some Freemason pose, which I had no idea. And now all I do is write back to him and say, I was. I absolutely was. And I love that anything you do can be blamed on the Freemason. So that's pretty much how
they've ultimately become they're like the brilliant scapegoats for everything.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. We actually try and do the opposite on the show. But back to the original point, like when you have your name on it,
mm-hmm.
that's what terrified me about the show, is because there's so many people that are working on it, so many people that are putting themselves into it. And it's getting the same judgment as my novel. I get all the credit or all the blame.
Yep.
And it I don't mind that when I write a novel because I did it.
It's true.
Right?
Yeah.
It's true. I should get all the credit or all the blame.
Same with stand-up. If I do a bad show, I get the responsibility for that, and I kind of like that.
And then to me, I'm like, that's okay. It's my fault. Thank you for making me hopefully
is it,
a better writer.
Is it your fault they drive around in a Porsche Cayenne all the
Let
time?
Let me tell you something. That Porsche, it would have killed them to give me a free Porsche.
Right? No, right? It wouldn't.
Like, I could fucking be bought. I have
it
a price.
Like, exactly.
I'm like, and I've made no bones about it, although they did ruin my favorite joke.
You could win the contest, though.
I do know the answer, so I'm going to win the contest.
Fantastic.
They don't know that.
What joke do they ruin?
They basically, so on last week's episode, there's this moment where, you know, so that's sponsored by Porsche, so Porsche's all over the thing. And in the episode, it's all about the inner circle. My novel is what the episode's about. And so it's all about George Washington spying, and he had this spying. And so they keep showing the book on the air. It's the most gratuitous hour of television of all time. So I basically at one point look at the camera and I say, you know, I just want to promise you right now there'll be no more product placement on the show except, of course, for that giant Porsche that they're driving around in, which is in the show, and it's a good joke, and everyone laughs.
Oh, they would
never
let
that fly.
But
the best part of the joke, oh, no, they let it fly, but here's what they ruined. Right after I say that, what to me is a great joke, and they actually left in, what they cut out is they pull out a little bit, and what you see is me reading my own copy of The Inner Circle.
And then
I literally look down, and I go, oh, Meltzer, you've done it again. And it's the greatest moment. And they're like, you are so not as funny as you think you are. And they just totally trashed it. And I was really pissed off. But they keep most of my jokes in. So
like the Porsche.
That's right. It's been revived. Right. It's been revived like Jim Varney's body.
Why would right. Porsche want be like, this is our show, Decoded. That's our target audience.
Because of the demo. It's all about the demographic. That's it.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, think about who watches the History Channel religiously.
It's like an older man. It's like a man who can buy a Porsche.
And it's people are generally, you're fairly academic if you're watching.
If you watch the History Channel,
except for the ghost shows. I don't fucking understand.
The ghost shows aren't on the History Channel.
Yeah, no, they're not on the History Channel.
I thought there was one ghost show on the History Channel.
An alien.
There's Ancient Aliens, of course.
Yeah, Ancient Aliens.
You got your Pawn Stars, your American Restorations, your American Pickers.
Ancient Aliens. So they just did everything with bronze tools, right?
Well, what they did was they influenced society,
right?
And made the Freemasons.
You took my line.
I'm sorry,
that was my line right there.
But we know now that actually it's the Doctor that influenced everything.
Well, we know that.
The Doctor?
Doctor Who.
Oh, now Noah's going. He's literally going right now. Doctor Who. I'm behind on Doctor Who. I'm on season 3. So don't, I know, but I'm behind. But I like it. I will say, there's moments that I love, but I find it, like X-Files, I love the ones when it's the bigger picture doctor. I don't like the Creature of the Week ones. I love, the most brilliant ones that they do are the ones when you get that moment where you find out he has a child. You know, that 1 second in the episode.
Right.
And then
you see it in the heartbreak and they fuck with it. And that is my favorite moment.
A lot of the, you know, Stephen Moffat is responsible for a lot of the super mind-bendy ones, which I absolutely love.
Yeah, and he's mind-bending the whole show now. It's like fun. I'm so happy that he took over.
I just like, but I don't like the Creature.
That's not to take away from Russell Davies, who apparently lives in Los Angeles now. So if you want to come on the podcast, Russell, we'll glad to have you.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to have Russell T. Davies.
And you do a lot of good stuff for the Who.
I'm a huge fan, and I'm excited. Gallifrey 1 is going to be going on in Los Angeles in February.
What weekend is that? It's the 20th, right?
That's the weekend of that show. The 20th. I think I might go to that.
How do you not go to that? You have to go to that.
Only for me, am I going to be in town. Okay. It's a question of am I going to be in town? Because my stand-up dates are it's been quiet. It gets quiet in December and January, and then February, March, April, May, spring rolls in. Then that's where the comedy dates kick in.
It's comedy season.
It's comedy season. It's season for comedy out there. Comedy seasonal, Brad. People like to hear jokes in the spring and the fall, and summer and winter. They don't fucking want to hear it.
That you think you're making? I've just come off a book tour. You know how many radio shows I've been on with that voice? I mean, I literally nobody's been on more radio.
So,
shows.
Brad.
Hey, Brad, I got a question. You ask a question. So you do a lot of history stuff. What did Cleopatra's pussy smell like?
Yeah, Brad.
This one was yesterday when the guy, I'm
is
not...
Is that Mary Queen of Scots queefing? Mary Queef of Scots, right here. Mary Queef of Scots.
Brad, did you hear that?
Yesterday's show, all the guy kept saying was the inner circle. He's like, the inner circle, and decoding. Your new show, Decoding. And I'm like, I wouldn't correct them. They're like, you know, and I can see that the person who like takes me to the public takes me around is like, you know, wants to correct. I'm like, don't correct it.
Now on the historical
channel.
The
Inner Circle and Decoding. I was like, I love it. This is the best titles, new titles that I've written.
Brad Miller's here with us today.
the worse it gets, the better it is. I love
it. Used to work with Jess Wheaton. Yeah. And,
Brad, you solve crimes,
like
right?
Guy, it's like that guy in The Onion, you know, the Paul Harvey, like the gossip comedy. Yeah. I love that. And it was just the living embodiment. It made me so happy.
What do you think about the Buffy reboot?
The movie, you mean?
Yeah.
You know, I'm too loyal to Joss. I can't, you know. First of all, I thought his response
was so funny.
Was the most brilliant, perfect. Like, so if you spent funny. A month on it, you couldn't have a better response to the response that he wrote when they announced it.
Well, I don't know.
Did you not see the response? It was basically, it was just this great response where, you know, because they want him to come out and say, you know, I hate it and this sucks and whatever. But he comes out with this, you know, listen, I wish I could say, you know, I will say that I'm really disappointed, you know, because it's really wrong to use anyone else's character, especially as I sit here with Captain America and the Hulk and the Avengers.
And then
he goes on and turns it, you know, and he just, but he, so he has, he's smart enough to poke fun at himself, you know, and knowing that you can't get on the high horse because you're already using someone else's characters in another project you're working on, but then also manages to put this, and again, in the perfect, you know, I thought Joss way of also making you get that feeling that, you know what, I'm going to also really tell you that I'm not for this, but with that, never being classless or bummed about.
Well,
it,
I just don't. I don't understand. You know, I think Hollywood is just too reboot crazy.
It's vampire crazy right now too.
Yeah, but I think what that whatever studio is doing it is grossly underestimating nerds because at least with, you know, with Captain America, we understand how the history of comic books work, and you know that those stories have been passed to many many hands, but the people who would go see a Buffy movie are indelibly tied to Joss. Yes.
Vindictively, you know. I mean, like literally, it's like a protest. You want to be like, you know what? I don't want to support that because I want to support the guy that I love and that's been there for us.
I think Joss is bigger than Buffy.
I think they're not going after the. I agree with that, but I think they're not going after the Buffy fans. They're going after the Twilight fans.
But that's the Twilight fans aren't going to. But first of all, the Twilight.
And I don't think there's a lot of crossover.
The Twilight fans
there.
Are too young to have watched Buffy.
Exactly.
They're not going
to
care.
But let me tell you something. Exactly. Get some hunky guy to play Angel, and get some like, you know, like the dark eyelid girl to play Buffy. Mm. That's what they're hoping for, right?
It's the worst of all possible worlds. They're not using Joss, and they're trying to capitalize on Twilight craze.
Yeah, exactly.
All of it.
Yeah, so it's.
Although I did
it'll
think
make money.
VR, that was my love of Twilight. I did.
I don't know
VR.
If it'll make money.
I
believe it will not make money.
And again,
friendly
all
bet
the execution.
Yeah,
let's put it in with that guy that does the pyramid bets. And,
yes,
Andrew Goldberg. What do you want to put on this?
Andrew Goldberg had a nice house, and he had a couch when we were watching.
Andrew Goldberg had a nice house.
He had a nice house, and he had a couch, a foldable couch, and we would watch original Star Trek in his basement. And then what we would do is we'd fold up the couch, and one of us would go into the trifold of the couch, and then we would close the couch.
Oh, I've been there.
While you were in. You know, and it was like, it was, you know, you were literally frozen in carbonite. You were just stuck there. And then, you know,
sounds like the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. It was horrifying.
But then you'd come out and almost die, and you'd be like, your turn. And then you'd be like, yeah, my turn. And I was like, this is the worst game ever.
Yeah, his mom had
her own electrolysis business in the back of the basement. And we would always just kind of be a step away from being like, want to pull out the electrolysis thing and zap each other and see if our eyebrows will go back.
Oh, my God.
But luckily, we were stuck in the couch, so we could never get
to the electrolysis. So you could never actually get to the electrolysis machine. Our bet's going to be the standard Duke and Duke bet from Trading Places.
$1 it is, sir.
$1. Yeah, oh, here, I can do that.
I need the noise.
Thank you, Lewis.
Yeah. That's it.
$1.
Still works. Still holds up.
That movie absolutely holds up.
Holds up.
Yeah.
Absolutely holds up.
I got that on Blu-ray.
Prime, no one could touch him.
112% that movie holds up. Everyone in that movie is fantastic.
I got that and Coming to America for $20 on Blu-ray. Both of them. It was a bargain. Right?
Yeah. I love Coming to America. I enjoy Coming to America. What are you watching right now on the TV besides Decoded?
That's all I watch. And we don't call it Decoded in my house. We call it Brad Meltzer's Decoded.
I call it Brad Meltzer's house. So if someone's gushing to you about your show,
I stop them and I say, please call up Brad Meltzer's Decoded.
I was going to say, do you call those people? Do you call that process Decoded fanning? Come on,
oh,
you guys.
Come on.
Now you came up with that?
Yep.
I like that. Impressed.
Yeah.
You're fast.
Yeah, but you gave me a rim shot though,
yeah,
so
I did.
that means you didn't like the joke.
But
I still stand behind Decoded fanning.
Yeah, that's good.
110%.
The best part is I'm going to go on another show until I use that as my joke, and no one's going to even know it.
And then I'll tweet to you.
Right, and then I'll be like, oh, hashtag. I like it.
Oh, I thought you were tweeting him the Reading Rainbow music sting. Ba-da-bum.
Nope.
Okay.
But we can do that.
Please.
And I'll tag LeVar Burton on it.
Oh, could we have him on? Let's get Will Wheaton first.
Will come
and
on.
Then
it's just been a scheduling
we'll
thing, and then LeVar will come on. But what else are you watching on the TV right now?
That, by the way, does not. Although I love Next Generation, but the special effects don't hold up.
No, they don't, because they're all done video processed.
I know, and I feel bad because I mean, I remember watching that, and those Borg episodes were the greatest thing of all time.
That's one other thing, too. As nerdy as much as I love Dave Matthews Band of the Red Sox, I probably love Star Trek The Next Generation more.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about your Dave Matthews. You know, the reason I forgot about your Dave Matthews sexual obsession
is irrelevant.
Is because...
You like his little foot shimmy that he
does? It's 2011, and they're not touring right now, and so I haven't heard anything about them lately.
It's a bad year for me. And I'm on the fence. Do I renew my membership for the fan club?
How are you going to get good tickets?
Exactly.
My brother-in-law is in the fan club.
Yeah, and I've been in there since December of 1998.
I think you really need to...
3 days after it started.
You got to keep that up.
You do it. You're right.
You're going to regret it.
Yeah, don't do that.
It's not like a gym membership. You can't go back and get your seniority back.
Yep, that's true.
Yeah, when you meet him, you can't be like, I was there in 98 to 2011.
I feel like they gave me better tickets when I was on the East Coast, and I don't know why that is. I got much better seats when I was in Boston.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, this is ridiculous to talk about.
Well, no, I'm just...
But anyway, yes, I love Star Trek The Next Generation so much, and we'll never get a Blu-ray because all the effects were video.
Oh, is that why?
Yeah, they processed it in video, so they can't transition it back.
I gotta say, I love when they did the... and this might piss off some Star Trek fans, but I love when they went back and released the first season of the original Star Trek with... with just some upgraded effects.
Oh, I watch it that way.
I actually
will say I don't love first original Star Trek. It doesn't work for me. It doesn't work.
You don't like the effects being redone, or you don't like the original Star Trek?
I just actually don't like the original Star Trek. It wasn't good to me until Khan, Wrath of Khan.
If you start with season two,
and I watched all of them. Make no mistake, it wasn't like I didn't see them or I didn't understand them. I watched them all. I just didn't like them as much.
Season two of the original series.
But when you have Ricardo Montalban with those fake pecs,
those are his real pecs.
Those are not his real pecs.
Those are his real pecs.
I've studied like. No man has studied
Decoded.
His pecs.
We need an episode.
I think we should decode his pecs.
Please.
The real Corinthian leather pecs, there's no way.
Rich Corinthian
Decoding
leather.
Decoding Ricardo Montalban's
masses. Kill you.
Chrysler made those pecs for him.
Actually, my pal Dave Mandel, he actually has the Khan costume.
What?
Yeah, oh yeah.
How's that?
It's awesome.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's pretty rad.
We should actually call him up right now. You know what? Let's email him right now, and I'm going to see if he has pecs that came with it. I'm going to email him right now.
There are no pecs. He's going to say. He's going to back me up and say that those were Ricardo Montalban's pecs.
We'll see.
So we still didn't, I still didn't get to
I'm
the bottom
get an answer. Oh, yes. What are we watching? What am I watching right now? You know what I love? I haven't seen this season yet, but I'm excited for it. I love Friday Night Lights. I have no reason to like it. I don't care about Texas. I don't care about football. But that first season just killed, and I want to see if they screwed up in the end.
All right.
So, but what am I watching that I like? It's actually hard to find. We're in the middle of Dexter. And we're early on in Dexter.
Just from the beginning of the
series? Yeah, just from the beginning. And what else am I watching right now that I really like? We finished The Wire. That was years ago. I haven't found anything that makes me go like, that's the best ever.
You're a busy guy, though. You're writing books. You're on tour. How many kids do you have?
Three.
You have three kids.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of kids. So I watch a lot. You know what I do? You know what I do watch? I watch a lot of old Simpsons with my son.
Okay.
Oh, that's
fascinating
good.
To watch because he started with the later episodes, and then I was like, no, you're getting ruined by this. Mm-hmm. And I brought him back, and I can tell you this, I made the very first Simpsons bootleg shirt. With me and Judd Winnick, at University of Michigan, when it came on, we used to go to the film festival and watch little shorts.
Yeah, right? Spike and Mike's Twisted Festival Animation.
We used to go to those every year. We saw them there. When they launched The Simpsons, the very first episode, we recorded on VCR, and we didn't even know what The Simpsons looked like at that moment. So I would pause it, and then Judd, that night after it aired, drew Homer and Marge and Matt, drew them all, and then I wrote what the word should be, and it was like them on the back of a Michigan shirt, and we went out, and we made 300 shirts. We had no money in college. This was the only way we were going to get through college. And we made 300 Simpsons T-shirts in the first week. We went into the dorms. And
literally.
We sold 300 shirts in an hour.
Holy
and then we
shit.
Were like, oh my gosh. And we were charging like $15, $20 a shirt. Then we went back. We made another 300 shirts. We sold those in 3 hours. We had like $5,000 of cash. We were like drug dealers. And when I met actually Bill Morrison, I said, he told me that Matt Groening actually collects the bootlegs. So I was like, I have the first bootleg. He collects all the illegal stuff. So that we made the very first Simpsons bootleg
wow.
all the time. And I still have a copy.
You're quite an entrepreneur.
Yeah, we were just desperate is what we were.
All right, I just got a text from Jonah Ray, by the way.
Yes.
The first text was, start without me. Olympic is moving insanely slow. So sorry, inching my way. Second text, and I just got pulled over taking a ride on red when I wasn't supposed to. I think I'm just going to go home. I don't feel well. This day fucking sucks. Sorry.
That's what you get when you stand me up. I'm sorry, pal.
Freemasons. Freemasons. Freemason cop.
First of all, it was. Okay, wait, Damon, what are we asking? Cons, pecs. She has a costume. Pecs in Trek 2. I'm trying to type fast so we can get an answer quickly. Real. I know you have the costume.
We know you have the costume.
I'm on Nerdist.
Right now?
I'm going to tell us that way he knows to write fast. I'm on Nerdist now.
You know, while you're texting right now, because sometimes texting isn't fun for people to listen to.
Yeah,
this is good radio,
me texting.
I will say that, just going back to our very early conversation, I'm thoroughly impressed that what I was going to say was that there is a generation of kind of fun, funny porn stars now. We kind of went off on a tangent a little bit when you were like, well, I mean, most of it's sad. And you're probably right, but, you know, like people like Dana D'Armond is funny, and this girl, April O'Neil, is funny, and who else do we know? Joanna Angel's funny and nice, and then one of the people on Attack of the Show said, oh, you have to follow this girl, Lexi Bell. She's really funny, and she writes really just insane but funny tweets. She's funny. She's genuinely.
And she's a porn star.
She is a porn star.
Well,
stress.
I mean, what are?
And she just shot something with Brett Gelman for Funny or Die too. Mm-hmm. So
that means funny.
Yeah,
that shows you're funny.
That means funny. So I'm just kind of I like to see, because I think a funny porn star could fucking corner the market, because when you think about the wealth of what's out there,
you could be president.
Yeah, you could literally be president of the United States, literally, and I don't mean that figuratively. I mean literally become the president of the United States
if you get the Illuminati on your side.
Yep.
And the Freemasons.
And you have to do that by letting them all jerk off onto you like you're one of those weird garden fountains that kids play in,
Sure.
What are those things called?
It's bukkake.
No. Yes. that the kids play with? Bukkake. What did you write back?
I'm waiting to hear.
That the kids play with.
He's actually, wait, let's see.
How did you meet the Sklars? Because it was Randy Sklar emailed me and said, oh my God, you got to have Brad Meltzer on. He's great. And I said, sure, yeah, you know, I'd love to have him on. And here you are. And you've been friends with the Sklars since college.
Yeah. The Sklars and I went, the Sklars came.
Wait, can I just ask you a quick question? How long was it before you could tell them apart?
Tell them apart?
Tell them apart.
Oh, tell them apart. Yeah. Oh, you know what? It took me about, actually, you know what? The funny thing is, maybe just like a month or two.
Oh, that's not bad.
Pretty good. Yeah, no. I don't think they, I think there's some twins, like Jennifer and Stephanie Blatt, who I went to high school with, I still can't tell apart. But Randy Jason, I can actually tell apart.
I can too now, but it took a couple years.
Yeah, it takes a while. But in college, a couple years, again, that's like a month.
I can too, and I don't even know how I do it.
No.
Well, besides Jay wearing glasses.
You have Sklar sense.
Oh.
Yeah, it is. But I met them in college, and they were 2 years behind me, and they came in, and we were actually all in, of all things, a fraternity. And we all kind of hated fraternities and what they stood for, but kind of came in to like just have fun and... And they brought in a comedy. They actually brought in a comedy tape.
You know, standing in for things like alcoholism and rape.
That's it. I mean, pretty much we were just, that was
well,
the
just
goal.
Date rape.
Yeah, they were.
It's like a fuck prank, a date rape. Yeah. Oh, it's a prank. It's like a prank.
It's like
you draw on someone.
I was only kidding.
You draw on someone's forehead when they're passed out. I was only kidding. Put your dick in them. It's like a fuck prank.
I was kidding.
Yeah. And it was an okay joke. People laughed. and so, but yeah, we met. Then the truth was they were like the anti, exactly what we wanted, which was people kind of hated that little part that we were in, and we were all together. And they actually came in with really funny comedy, and I never knew anyone who did comedy before. And I was so impressed that they knew before anybody what they wanted to be. Right? They knew back when they were 18 years old that they wanted to do stand up comedy. They had like they won this thing in St. Louis where they could call an inning of a baseball game. And they prepared, I'm guessing, for like, you know, forever. And then, you know, most people would be like, okay, here's, I can't do a sports reference, so I'll say Reggie Jackson, and you know, announce the name, and that was the bit. And they did like a whole on bit. And plus, they could do the scene, the jive talk scene from Airplane as brothers better than anybody.
Well, they're board minded.
Right. They're
a singular mind.
I mean, even back then they were. And now they've upped it later. In fact,
when five-minded twins.
My senior year of college, there was a competition that was supposed to be a talent competition. And I had no talent, but I wanted to enter the competition because the very first thing, there were three rounds of the competition. And the rounds were you had to be a hero. And I wanted to do Spider-Man. And the Sklar's dad used to sell Velcro by like the caseloads. And so he sent us industrial level Velcro, like a crate of it.
Holy shit!
And so I bought a sweatsuit that was red, and then he sent us all this Velcro, and I ripped off Letterman and did a Velcro suit, but did it as Spider-Man, and that's all I wanted to do. I wanted to jump off a trampoline and stick to a wall and say I was Spider-Man, and that's all I entered this competition for. I had no talent. I had nothing I could do, but I was like, it'll be really fucking funny to do that, and it was funny on Letterman, and most of these people probably never saw Letterman, so I'm going to do it. So it was totally like me stealing from Letterman, and I jumped off a trampoline, and I stuck to the wall, and it worked great, and the crowd went bananas, and they said, and Randy and Jason were like, you're going to get to the next round, and you're going to have to enter the talent part of the competition, and it narrows at that point to 10 people, you know, from like hundreds of people, there was like 100 people and then to 10, and the people who get to the second round, they have real talent. So there was like this classic violinist, there was, you know, people who were playing classical piano, I mean, all these real talents. I had nothing, and of course I made it to the next round because it was good Spider-Man, and it was a really good Spider-Man. And we had like Silly String as the web, so you could actually see it. It was good stuff.
Organic web shooters or
no, this was the old days. There was no organic. Come on, organic web shooters. What kind of show you think this is?
Okay.
And so basically, and they said we're going to write you a bit, and I was like, okay. And so I actually did a sock puppet stand-up. It was a puppet show, a sock puppet show. And so all these people are going out and, again, playing these amazing pieces, these classical pieces. And then I walk out on stage with two socks on my hand that don't match. And the scores, the way they wrote it for me, it was we had to make it as bad as possible. So, like, it showed me how hard comedy can be because it was completely crafted. We worked for a week on it.
Were the puppets called Randy and Jason?
No, they were called Pippi and Poopy. Those were the puppets. And, we made it so awful. Like, it was just, we were like, this is Pippi and this is Poopy, the puppets. And then, as I said, the puppets, I turned both hands to the audience.
Uh-huh.
And it just was so cheesy on purpose. And then, you know, I was doing it and Randy would be like, no, you have to make the hand motion not match your mouth. so it'll be extra bad. And so they were literally coaching me, and I never appreciated what it takes to do a good comedy bit, and they coached me to do this extra bad puppet show. And basically what happens in the puppet show is the two puppets start arguing with each other, and I, of course, am both puppets, and then they start fighting, and then I'm literally screaming at myself, you know, where were you, and why'd you take all my laundry money, and, you know, you should get out of here, we're never going to get married. And then I storm off the stage in, like, a mad, crazy rage vein down my forehead yelling like a maniac. And it was completely out there comedy, right? It would have – if I did that – bit in Boca Raton, literally, it would be silence. No one would.
I think you need to be doing this on your book tours.
And I'm not joking. The place went, but I actually won the entire competition. And now the best part was, is, you know, this guy who's playing classical piano is like looking at me and he's like, I fucking just lost.
Do you know
the
how many? Do you know how many Asian kids were beaten within an inch of their lives
because
they lost to the sock puppet guy?
I know. The tiger mom killed them. I mean, literally, and we won it. And I was just like, you guys just won me that whole competition.
Velcro enthusiast Brad Meltzer.
So that was my.
Wow.
That's a great Sklar story.
It was, I mean, never been told
Sklar
before.
Stories.
Although that bit was a little resclarded. Come on, you guys. Come
that
on.
Was, okay.
Did I do it done?
No, that's fine.
It's Bukkake, Chris.
Bukkake. I think that's genius.
It was. Oh, wait. Dave Mandel wrote back. Costume has no fake pecs. I was always told they were real.
Uh-oh.
Interesting.
I impressive. Was told that, too.
100% Multibond.
Nicholas Meyer, the director of that film.
Let's talk a little bit about organic web shooters versus scientifically constructed web shooters. Because, you know, at first I was... I, when I heard about Andrew Garfield, I was like, I don't know. Do they really need to? Do we really have to?
No, we don't need
to. But I have to say, I thought he was really fucking great in Social Network.
Yeah, in Social Network. I don't mind the reboots. I don't like. For me, that to me wasn't about story. I don't think that. I mean, I have no idea. I have no inside knowledge. But to me, rebooting Spider-Man was all about money.
But let me ask you a question about maybe this was addressed somewhere in the comics, but. The web shooters that Peter Parker makes,
mm-hmm.
How much chemical web could they physically hold?
Not only that, I was okay with the organic. You know why? Because if he made that, I was always like, sell it. You don't need to be poor, Peter. I mean, I literally was always like, why are you bitching about money? Just go sell that freaking
web. Because then the whole town would just be like a kind of like drapery of...
I'm saying, but, you know, it made... you know, it was like... They always used the word tensile, right? It was like tensile steel. And I was always like, you could find any... There's a lot of things you can... If you can make that, you can make something. You don't need to be like the crappy photographer. So
yeah,
that,
actually, yeah.
So that's to be explained
yeah,
the hard
he,
part.
He makes a perfect web shooter... I mean, maybe it took him a couple of tries, but
right.
It certainly didn't take him long,
right,
not
right.
years.
I mean, I was just like, that's why when they had the Fantastic Four lose all their money, I was like, well, Reed is going to patent something new. He's a pretty smart guy.
Yeah.
Like, I was, that's, it doesn't, so to me, I was okay. It's not that I care. The only thing I didn't like is I like how it looks better when it's on the inside of the wrist.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it looks cooler like when you make the pose. So that was it. Because I used to have the one, did you ever have the one when you were little, that the suction cup one? You know what I'm talking about, the web shooter? And I used to, I mean, I spent so many hours in my bathroom trying to hit the mirror and make it stick, and that was, it always was here. Yeah. And I think, although you had to put it here, you had to squeeze here, and I would always turn it around to my wrist, because that's how Peter did it.
We had that, and then did you have the Bionic Man action figure?
Please,
where you
could look through his eye?
You look through the back of his head, just through his eye?
That's like...
That was, quote-unquote, magnified?
Yeah, no, I not only that, there was another toy that was around the same time, that had a robot arm that came off and it shot his arm, and I can't remember the name of the toy. I've been looking for it, and it used to be fun because you'd find that stuff at, like, you know, you go to Comic Con, you go to even a Holiday Inn hotel convention, and you'd find like a good old Mego doll.
Yeah.
And now with eBay, it takes all the fun out of it, right? Because you could just go, you want all the Mego dolls, all mint in box here, $4,000.
You've gone from being hunter gatherers to just gatherers.
Yeah, it's no fun. Like the chase is the.
It's
whole
funny
thing.
Too how that damaged the market for things that people thought were really rare, and then turns
right,
out.
No,
oh,
it's not.
There's
we actually played a game one
those.
Night. We had some friends over. We tried to figure out what can you not buy on eBay. We tried, and the contest was you'd have to come up with something that couldn't be bought on eBay that wasn't, you know, a baby or like something that was living. You know, like we took those things out.
You can buy babies
out.
On eBay,
right? I mean, you know, those are the. But we and it's hard. It's hard to come up with obscure crap that's not on eBay.
Should we? But now that we're all having the conversation, should we start a black market baby service called eBaby?
And yep. Let me tell you what that'll do to you because I know the result.
Okay.
Here's what's going to happen. So when I was in high school, there was a scavenger hunt.
Okay.
Okay. You can look this up. And the dummies, I was working at Haagen-Dazs that night because I actually needed money, and all the rich kids who didn't need money were all out having scavenger hunts like the rich kids.
Where was this?
In North Miami Beach, Florida.
Okay.
Okay. And what happened was, is someone put at the bottom of the list, they had, you know, like street signs and the normal stuff you put in, someone put at the very bottom of the list a live baby.
Oh, my.
Okay. And one of the, in stealing stuff, the one car got pulled over and got, you know, basically the cop was like, hey, you guys got all the stolen stuff and like was going to take him to jail, but he pulled out the list. Mm-hmm. And when he pulled out the list and saw a live baby, he was like, you guys are trying to kidnap a baby. And he puts out the, you know, like all points, bulletin, everyone, they're trying to kidnap a baby, these people.
Oh,
and
no.
The entire North Miami Beach, this is true. And now because of the story, it makes the New York Times. Our scavenger hunt makes the New York Times. And which was the greatest thing of all time. And the only better part of it, it was all the really smart kids in the school. And the kid who was one of the people who got arrested was gotten to Harvard and gotten to Stanford. And everyone was like, you got to go to Harvard. Harvard's for the smart people. You got to go to Harvard. And he basically, the whole moment of being arrested and then being in the New York Times and then being bailed out of jail, it changed him. It was like out of a Star Trek episode. He literally morphed into a different person. And he said, you know what? I need to be a different person. And he flipped a coin. And it was like Two-Face. And the scar side came up, and he went to Stanford instead. And that was the biggest controversy in NMB that year.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
All real.
I wonder if Harvard's got to be like the hot girl. Like, what do you mean you don't want to fuck me?
That's right.
And then they'd get really insecure all of a sudden.
But it was. And then it was only topped a couple of years ago in Boston. Where are you from?
I'm from Lowell.
Okay, so you remember in Newton a couple of years ago there was a scavenger hunt where like all these kids, it made the New York Times again, and we were all mad because their scavenger hunt made the New York Times, and it kind of took away our power.
Usurped your...
Yeah,
you were still first, though.
We were first, yeah. I had nothing to do with this thing, but I make ownership of it now.
That's fine.
But I was working at Hot
Girls. I'm not having any of those people on the podcast. Yeah, you might as well fucking take ownership over the story.
I did it all.
I lived in Miami for a while. My mom's from Miami.
You did? Mm-hmm. Where'd you live in Miami?
We lived in Miami Lakes for a while. We lived in Boca Raton. My grandfather owned a couple bowling centers in Miami.
Yeah.
He owned a place called Palm Springs Lanes, which closed years and years and years ago.
The bowling alley by us was by the bread factory. And when they take you from school to go bowling, you could smell all the wholesome bread. So all the kids would be like sniffing out the window. You'd be like sucking up to them because bread smells good.
And then that's, of course, destroyed when you go into a bowling center and all you can smell are cigarettes and feet.
Cigarettes and feet.
That's all it is.
That's
so is there anything that we can promote from you? You're at Brad Meltzer on the Twitter?
Yeah, at Brad Meltzer on Twitter and on Facebook.
What's coming up for you, Brad Meltzer?
I don't know. I guess we find out whether they renewed Decoded or not. So I have no idea what they're going to do. I mean, they seem happy with the ratings, but you know, until they say it, I don't believe anything. And then working on the new novel.
How long will it take you to write that book?
It'll take me 2 years.
Wow.
Do a book every 2 years?
I try, and I barely make it.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people who put out a book a year, and more power to them. But if I put out a book a year, it would be garbage. It would be churned out like regurgitated garbage.
Now, what I'm curious about is when you think about the concept of writing a new book, do you feel the sinking in the pit of your stomach, like, I got to start this shit over again? Or is there some perspective that you can shed? Because a lot of people, I mean, there are a lot of writers who listen to the show, and I know people are always kind of looking for emotional shortcuts around, you know, these kinds of overwhelming seeming tasks. So,
no,
do you have some shortcuts? Do you have some?
Yeah, I know. I mean, if you have some, send them my way. I mean, I'm on book. I've written 8 novels, right? 8 times I've done this, and I'm still terrified starting the 9th. And every day that I sit down to write, I got my first book got 24 rejection letters. And to be clear, there were only 20 publishers at the time, and I got 24 rejection letters, which means some people are writing you twice to make sure you get the point.
Oh.
Every day I sit down. I remember there were 2 publishers that were interested, and my agent said, "I think one of them is going to make a bid on your book." And I was like, "Fantastic!" And so I was waiting for the phone to ring just to tell, you know, she was going to tell me that, you know, it was sold. And I picked up the phone, all excited to find out who bought my novel. And I picked up the phone and said, "Okay, tell me." And she went, "Sorry, kiddo." And to this day, every day that I sit down to write, I mean, literally, those are her words. But every day I sit down to write, I say the word "sorry, kiddo" to myself mentally because I want to bring myself right back to that moment and appreciate, like, that's actually what I was talking about.
Don't forget it. Spit it out.
So here's what it was, because we were talking about staying hungry. That's what it was. We were talking about staying hungry. To me, I do that every day to stay hungry. I need to remember, talk about if we did this on purpose, it would have looked like genius, but total accident.
We did it on purpose.
We totally did it on purpose. Don't tell anyone. But I think you need to stay hungry or you lose it. And I'm terrified, like after writing 8 novels, of losing it. So every day I sit down, I think of my worst moment ever writing, and I repeat it in my head to bring myself back to that moment where it can all be taken away.
Oh, that's really interesting.
That's why, because you were talking about staying hungry and how you stay hungry.
Can I tell you that I think it is better that you remembered it during this part than what we were talking about before, where it sort of would have been an ancillary point to what we were... we're saying, but now, like, the idea that you're able to fold it into this advice to people for
no,
you know,
but that's that's what I need to do. Like, I know my body. For me, the chase matters. Like, not being able to do something matters to me, and it's why, like, trying a TV show, I don't know if I could do it, so I'm going to try it. I never tried to write a series of novels with a repeating character, so that's what I'm trying now.
Hey, it's not going to fucking hurt, and the upside is a huge upside. That's like, out. If it hits, it changes your life. If it doesn't hit, hey, you know, no one will remember. It doesn't matter. I can try it again some other time.
But that's exactly what we were talking about before, is not having being comfortable enough with yourself to be able to try that, not to turn into, like, a self-help moment. But I think that's what it is. It's like when you're comfortable enough to be that it's okay to fail, I think you'll get your best work, because then you're there's nothing more attractive than someone who's comfortable in their own skin. Like, when people say what's cool, it's the person who just doesn't care what anybody else thinks. And when you get to that, I feel like, you know, for comedy, I feel like for writing, I feel like for creative, that's where you get your best stuff. And I need to bring myself to that moment every
day. And how do you feel like people can get comfortable in their own skin?
I don't know. I think, you know, I actually do think, I mean, I guess some people go to therapy and do things like that. For me, my novels are my therapy. Like, those are my imaginary friends where I work out. I mean, you show me a novel and I'll show you what the author is dealing with at that time. Like, my mom died, that novel that I wrote, and I didn't even know she was going to be dead by the end of the novel because I didn't know what was going to happen to her. But that novel is a guy who's dealing with his dead mother, and you'd think I would be pretty clear about that, but it was me absolutely working out what I was working out as honestly as I can on the page, but not even being conscious of it because I didn't know she was going to die. She had just gotten sick. Mm-hmm. And I was just terrified of that, so I made this guy who lost his mom and was just working through all those feelings. I think the only way you get there is I do think you have to – you do have to self-analyze in some way, and sometimes it's, you know, I guess for some people it's a shrink. For me, it's just writing books. That's where I do it.
Yeah, that is fantastic advice. Fantastic advice. And The Sorry Kiddo, which is incredibly cinematic.
And it's not really cinematic because it's just me in my office. But
yeah, no, but I mean, just even but those two words, like, that you'd see that in a movie, like, Sorry Kiddo, and then you just
I had to keep on my phone what I was looking at when she said it to me.
And then, so when you sit down to write every day, you say that, and you remember to stay hungry, and then I assume you put on Survivor's Eye of the Tiger, right?
Yeah, I do the You're the Best Around from Karate Kid.
You're the best around. Nothing's gonna ever get
you. Can I tell you, by the way, my son, we're in the Rocky movies right now that we're watching. We're up to Rocky 4, and he...
are you going to show him Rocky 5?
No. Okay. I told him there's no Rocky 5.
Good.
I told him there's no Rocky 5, but I told him that there is Rocky Balboa. And the thing is now he can read, so he went on the internet, and he goes, Dad, there's Rocky 5.
I don't think so.
Nope, that's homemade. It's totally fanfic. I'm like, and he does, I just totally lie. But he watched Rocky IV, and he just watched Miracle, and no child in America hates the Russians more than my child right now. Nobody hates the Russians. Like, they're remaking Red
Dawn.
Son,
it's not the USSR anymore. No, there's no Cold War.
He's like, those fucking Russians. And I told him that Red Dawn, they're going to make it, and the Chinese are going to kill us because, you know, Hollywood wants us to think Chinese are going to kill us. And he's like, no, the Chinese aren't going to kill us, Dad. It's the Russians we got to worry about. I'm like, you are right, son. You are totally right. The Russians are coming.
So you're constructing a universe for your kid where Russians are evil and there's no Rocky V.
That's 1985. No difference. I mean, he lives in the Skinner box of 1985.
And you have that power as a parent.
I mean, you do. And you know what? I think he'll thank me later.
He might, actually.
Or he'll kill me later. One of those things.
Listen, you know, we're inundated with so much data at all times. You know, if you can help, if you have to be a filter and an aggregator for your own kids, as a parent, that's the kind of shit parents should be doing. You're actually paying it. You are paying so much attention to your kids.
I think his life gets a little better when he has to wait for Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah,
I agree.
I think it does. I think his quality of life...
Because he won't appreciate it. He wouldn't appreciate his game
of thrones.
He burned
through those three movies in 6 hours. He would have been like, okay, let's go see it. I'm like, no, you have to wait. I waited that many years. You're going to wait 6 months. And 6 months when you're little is a long time. It was a long time. So he'll thank me later.
Well, Brad Meltzer, this has been an absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much. Because you're only in town for a day, right? You're passing through.
I'm going on Red Eye tonight. I'm out.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. It was a genuine pleasure. And sorry, Jonah couldn't be here. He was off violating the law. And right now he's probably punching a wall, but with his ticket.
Yeah.
He's probably furiously masturbating with his ticket rolled up.
He's got a beer.
Getting a ticket ruins everything.
It really does.
It does.
It really does, because it's also you're flustered, and the cops know you're flustered.
You know how to get out of a ticket, though? You want me to tell you the secret?
Yeah,
this is true.
Start crying?
No. If you're a woman, the number one way to get out of a ticket, right? The number one way to get out of a ticket. My buddy, who was a police officer, he said the number one thing that nobody says when they get pulled over. You know, cause what's the number one thing? I'll tell you this way. What's the number one thing that everyone says?
How fast was I going?
I didn't know. How fast was I going?
Yeah.
The only thing that they don't say is I'm sorry.
I always say that, and I've never gotten a ticket.
If you start with I'm sorry, you will get out of your ticket. And I've tried it now 3 times, and I've gotten out of 3 tickets. And my friend said to me, it's like, say I'm sorry, because if they're pulling you over, they know you did it. Don't try and talk your way out of it. You're not going to fool them. Say I'm sorry. And anyone who says they're sorry, thank me later when you get out of it. And if you don't get out of it, that was Chris.
Why were you such a dick about it?
Right.
I am so sorry, you fascist twat nozzle.
Yeah.
Would that help?
Sometimes it works.
Well,
only in the southern states.
I'm so sorry that you have a mustache.
Although I got pulled over with a guy named Isaac Ben Shmuel, the most Israeli name and looking guy ever, and he had a high earring. And we got pulled over in South Carolina, and he did not get out of his ticket.
No, that might not.
That South Carolina cop did not let Isaac Ben Shmuel.
I am sorry.
Hearing.
For 9/11, you goddamn right you are, son.
I mean, and he gave us 2 tickets. He gave us the, like, your front, what's the taillight, the front light, your front light was broken. I mean, and it wasn't. We got 2 tickets.
Like in Porky's, they smashed the light.
It was.
You got
it was
a
like
busted
the, it was
taillight,
like,
son.
That was just like
that. Those places still exist,
and
then man.
I put my penis in a shower, and it was just, everything was.
Is that Tommy Turner in there?
The thing was, to this day, I remember seeing Porky's in the theater, and I was like, that's it?
Well, yeah, because it was supposed to be so sexy and body.
I was like,
it's
not even it. There's nothing.
Yeah, but Kim Cattrall gets fucked on a pile of
she
gym clothes.
Did. That's true. But everyone talked about the penis scene. It was all about the penis in the wall scene.
Yeah.
And you couldn't see anything. I was like, if you're going to show it, show it. I don't care.
Boy, that scene where in front of Miss Ballbreaker, where the guy says, I have an idea. Why don't we call out one of the sketch artists? That used to slay me when I was. I gotta rewatch Porky's and see if it holds up. That's my assignment for next time.
That it doesn't.
It might not.
That was Bob Clark, right?
It might not.
The guy that did the Christmas Story.
I just rewatched Christmas Story.
Yeah.
It's slower, but the funny parts do hold up. The funny parts.
Yeah,
do hold
absolutely.
Up. I watched it this Christmas with my kids.
It was so poisoning. Fucking funny.
Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed the burrito today on the podcast. Poor Jonah is not enjoying his burrito right now,
but he will later. He'll have one later and he'll enjoy it.
So again, thanks, Brad. Thanks for coming on.
No, thank you, brother.
At Brad Meltzer on the Twitter and on Facebook. Goodbye. Signing off.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.